Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter. Diesmal aus dem Bruno-Kreisky-Forum. Wir wollen heute einen Ausblick auf unsere Welt im Jahr 2021 versuchen, und zwar unter verschiedenen Blickwinkeln, aus europäischer Sicht, aus russischer Sicht, aus asiatischer Sicht, und so die Vielfalt unserer Welt einzufangen. Was bedeutet der Erfolg Asiens im Umgang mit dem Coronavirus? Was ändert sich in der Stellung Amerikas in der Welt durch die neue Administration Joe Biden, die es ab dem 20. Jänner geben wird? Und wenn Wladimir Putin in die Welt schaut, fühlt er sich als der Gewinner, wenn die Europäer Schwierigkeiten haben und die Amerikaner Schwierigkeiten haben? Das alles besprechen wir in dieser Sendung in einer hochrangigen internationalen Runde. Aus Moskau wird die Russland-Expertin Nina Khrushcheva teilnehmen, aus Südkorea der China-Korrespondent der New York Times und aus Wien die ehemalige Botschafterin Eva Novotny. Wir sind über das Internet alle online verbunden. Diese Sendung kommt aus dem Wohnzimmer Bruno Kreiskys. Das ist kein Gag, sondern das ist wirklich so. Hier in diesem Raum hat der frühere Bundeskanzler gearbeitet und gelebt. Das ist jetzt der Sitz des Bruno-Kreisky-Forums. Von hier aus werden internationale Konferenzen und Diskussionen organisiert, sowie auch dieser Podcast. Und dieser Meinungsaustausch wird in englischer Sprache durchgeführt, ausnahmsweise nicht auf Deutsch. And I'm very glad, let me welcome Nina Khrushcheva in Moscow. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Nina Khrushcheva is one of the most important Russian experts in academia in the United States. She's teaching in the famous New School in New York, and she's also the granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, the former Soviet leader, well known for many Austrians. Nina Khrushcheva, you are in Moscow now. If you look at the world, is the perspective on the world in Moscow, seen from Russia, any way comparable to the perspective on the world seen from the United States, seen from New York, or are these worlds apart?
Well, I mean, they're never the same perspective, obviously. They don't look at the world in similar ways. First, it's the legacy of the Cold War, but also since Russia continues to be, as Americans, many politicians or pundits say, that it's the greatest adversary the United States has. And the same thing you can hear in Russia. So in this sense, the perspective is similar, but yet it's the complete opposite. There was a little bit of a hope that COVID-19 would make perspectives unite in some way, but of course, unfortunately, it didn't happen. And now there is this vaccine debate. So the Russian vaccine that was registered first, the vaccination began, I think, last week, now is seen as something that was done in a rushed way. And so Putin was trying to muscle himself into this great club of first world leaders to provide the world with vaccine. And, you know, so the Russians now say that the West is maligning their efforts. So that is already a contradiction in many ways, and difference between the Russian perspective and, of course, the U.S. perspective.
The pandemic, do you feel it in Moscow in a similar ways than we feel it in Europe,
or people
feel it in New York?
COVID?
Yes, the pandemic. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think you feel it everywhere. I mean, I don't know. I haven't been in Europe, so I don't know exactly how you feel it. But you in New York, you feel it every single second, but also not only because, of course, the United States has the largest number of infections and death, but also because American culture, and Stephen probably is going to disagree with me or maybe agree with me, it does have a bit of sensationalism in it. So it turns everything, even the actual real drama, it turns into a more enhanced drama. So in America, COVID not only is a disaster, but it's also kind of a bad entertainment movie, while in Moscow it is a disaster, but people kind of get along with their lives. So yes, you do feel it, and Russia is the fourth in the world in terms of infections, in terms of the number of infections. You feel it, but it's, you know, one of the things, and we can talk about it more, although I'm not sure it's our kind of topic today, but the thing that America doesn't have and Russia still has is the kind of public service. As much as has been said, ruined in the last 30 years with the chaotic capitalization that happened after 91, there's still public good and public service. So there is a better care in relations to COVID, probably far inferior to Europe, I can imagine, but certainly far superior to the United States. But I guess one of the things that, you know, what you do feel and discuss in Moscow is the Trump's loss in the elections, or actually the Russians don't say he is lost. They're waiting for the technical, actually today, the Electoral College. So supposedly they will then confirm or deny Trump's loss. But basically American elections and what's going to be expected of the new Joe Biden administration, though once again, the Russians are very careful to say that Joe Biden has won. And I assume that that's going to be our big conversation for today's panel.
And I'm very glad that we have Stephen Lee Myers with us. Hello.
Hello.
Stephen Lee Myers is China bureau chief for the New York Times, but residing in Seoul because of a dispute between the Chinese authorities and many foreign journalists, American journalists too. So you were reporting on China out of Seoul. Do you think that might change with the new administration? There might be new possibilities for American journalists, also for you, to go back to Beijing?
You know, it's interesting because the Chinese government has even hinted at the possibility that it would meet any action that the new administration takes with reciprocal actions in return. So there's a possibility. Some people have speculated that one of the easier areas to begin cooperation again after the last couple of years of conflict would be to resume people-to-people cultural exchanges, as well as, you know, the tit-for-tat restrictions on journalists that that both countries have imposed, and which resulted in me and my colleagues getting kicked out.
And I'm very happy to welcome in her home office in Vienna, Eva Novotny. Hello.
Hello.
Eva Novotny is one of the top foreign policy experts in Austria. She has been Austrian ambassador in Washington, in London, and in Paris, among many other assignments. Eva, the year 2021 is a year after a year of many dramatic changes of the year 2020. How do you see Europe? It is still a very a world of instability, a big instability. Do you see Europe at the end of 2020, at the beginning of 2021, prepared for the instability that we will witness and that will persist in 2021?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I would answer, Raymond, that it is both at the moment. You see signs that are very promising, and we have just seen those signs, for instance, over the weekend when the 27 members of the European Union got together. They made very good decisions concerning climate problematic, made good decisions concerning the future relationship to the United States. They maintained the unity in dealing with Brexit, in the Brexit negotiations, which is also an important factor. At the same time, COVID and the pandemic has in a way exacerbated some tendencies that were already here, because it has put the main responsibility of dealing with the crisis and the consequences of the crisis to the nation state. So we have at the moment a tangle of sometimes contradictory informations and measures in the various member states of the European Union that make life for a European citizen quite difficult, different quarantine regulations, etc. I think we, if we are looking at that, at that whole situation in light of the political changes that are going to take place in Washington, there has been a moment of sort of awakening for Europe, where they realized, and almost all member states of the European Union did realize, not to the, all to the same extent, that they have to be more autonomous in their decision-making, more autonomous in their security policy, more self-reliant in the way they go about their international stance. So in a way, the answer is twofold to your question. On the one side, Europe has got its act together, has made progress, has done a lot of things which are important, but some problems are still there, which have to be tackled.
Nina Khrushcheva, how does Russia look at Europe nowadays? In the next new year, 2021, we had confrontations, tensions around the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader. We still have these tensions around Ukraine. Do you see the Putin leadership being looking at 2021, being ready to try to re-engage with Europe, or is that a situation where the Russian leadership thinks Europe is weak and hardline will prevail?
Well, they keep saying that they would like to re-engage. But I think Alexei Navalny was a very important moment in the relationship, as you mentioned, because for Europe, there is no question that Navalny was poisoned, must have been poisoned by the Russian security forces. And Russia, of course, says we have nothing to do with that. But I think the important thing that happened is that for many years, certainly, if not decades, there was kind of an understanding that Germany understands Russia better, that Germany, even if there are certainly voices of criticism, there's some sort of even silent understanding and deals are being made nonetheless, despite the European Union rejection of Russia's Ukraine policy, the sanctions and so on. And with Germany coming out and saying very deliberately that that Navalny indeed most likely got poisoned was prompted from many corners and from the Kremlin, the response that said, well, you know, basically we're not expecting any relationship to get better with Europe. And if Europe doesn't want to kind of deal with us, we're not going to deal with that. We're not going to deal with that, which is kind of a familiar Russian stance, because Russia is always a victim of everybody's misunderstanding on one hand. On the other hand, we'll see how that plays out. I don't know. I'm sure you followed. I think just yesterday, the Times of London came out with an investigative piece saying that Navalny was, in fact, being poisoned twice. So one time in the Siberian city of Tomsk, and then when he got to the hospital in Omsk, barely alive, they tried, the KGB, FSB, the security forces tried to poison him second time, which is a little bit, I think, is a hit job, just because, you know, how incompetent Putin's security forces. I mean, they probably could be incompetent, but not that incompetent. But it does seem that that is, I mean, England decided that it's no longer part of Europe. But anyway, it is seems to be a British response, or maybe kind of the transatlantic Anglo-Saxon response to the fact that Nord Stream 2, as you know, the very kind of controversial pipeline between Russia and Germany, in fact, began working again. I mean, Americans have tried to sanction it, actually sanctioned Germany was against. And so I think what's interesting is that what we are dealing with now is that once again, the triangle of interest. So you have Russia on one hand fighting with Germany over Navalny. On the other hand, Germany is still having economic ties and sort of continuing deals with Russia, while the United States is also trying to play, or will probably try to play, a little bit of a more detailed dance around Europe, because it cannot, like Trump, say, well, if you're going to be involved with Russia on Nord Stream 2 or some other things, we're just going to sanction you away, because that would give a bad message to the United States. So I think the game continues, as they say, and since Putin, although now he's more like a kind of grand patriarch, sort of the god talking to the nation from somewhere from high heaven, because we don't know exactly where he is when he does speak to the nation or attends his meetings, Zoom meetings. On one hand, he does that. On the other hand, being a former kind of KGB man himself, it does seem to be continue his interest. So he's playing this game of an operative, who can outsmart whom in which directions. And so to conclude, I think it also depends on how connected the European relationship would be with the new Biden administration, and also how many mistakes will be made in those, because we do know if Putin stays in power, which, you know, now is also here, there's always, Moscow is filled with rumors, is that, you know, he has Parkinson's, he's dying from cancer, or something is going to happen to him tomorrow, or he's going to stay for another how many more years or decades, as long as he is alive. So he will continue to play this very refined game of trying to use opportunities, use mistakes, wedge, little kind of misunderstanding between relationship, but also trying to build up his own relationship with the stronger side that may decide that it needs Russia for, say, nuclear negotiations or climate negotiations. I haven't mentioned those. So I think, as Sherlock Holmes would say, the game is afoot, and I think Putin is being sort of watching the Biden and then European relationship very closely.
Stephen Lee Myers, seen from Asia, mainly from China, I would say, does Europe look weak, or on the other side, Europe got its act together, vaccinations are going to be distributed through the European Commission, Europe hardens its position towards China. How do you see the Chinese, how do the Chinese see the perspective, their perspective for Europe in the next year?
You know, if you remember, this year began with great hopes of a renewed commitment between Europe and China. That was derailed by the pandemic, of course, but also I think the shifting views you alluded to. There is a hardening of views toward China in Europe, across Europe, even in places where there was a greater sense of sympathy or a greater willingness to work with China. And I think that changed partly because of the repressions in Xinjiang, and then also the harsh crackdown that unfolded in Hong Kong, even as the pandemic was boiling over in the rest of the world. And I also think even China's handling of the initial outbreak and the obfuscation that was involved in that, I think that really soured people on China generally, not just in the United States, which of course captured a lot of the headlines, especially this year with the election, but across Europe and beyond. And I think China has woken up to that, and they realize they have a diplomatic problem. They sent the foreign minister, this this fall. He had a kind of disastrous trip across Europe. But it's interesting to see Xi Jinping reaching out even now, trying to, I think, repair some of the damage that was done. He had a conversation with President Macron the other day and talked again about the areas where China and Europe should be cooperating. That said, they haven't been able to reach the investment pact that Angela Merkel had worked so hard to try to get done this year. Again, partly because everything was derailed by the pandemic. A lot of the face-to-face meetings didn't happen. But it looks pretty clear now that that's not going to happen. That agreement, which even that is short of what some people wanted. So I think that there's going to be a huge reset that's going to happen inevitably with the new administration, because I think what they have signaled, the Biden people, is that they want to work together with traditional American allies to come up with a coherent Chinese strategy. How do you deal with this rising power that is way ahead of everyone else in recovering from the pandemic because of the way they were able to wrest it under control early in the spring? You know, there's not a second wave going on in China right now.
Amazing, right? Amazing. Seen from America or Europe, it's amazing. We're talking about the third wave now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you mentioned the perspective before. When you talk to people in China, they look at what's happening in the United States and Europe with absolute shock. No one can believe that it's so bad, especially in the United States. And there are many who relish that, by the way, and they use that to talk about, you know, the triumph of the Chinese system. The governance of the Communist Party has prevented this pandemic. And, you know, as it gets worse around the world, you know, they're able to point to their success and say, see, we have a better governance, a better way of leading people, even despite all of the crackdowns that cause people outside such worry.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The new world will be a world with a new administration in Washington, D.C. Joe Biden and his team will come start office on the 20th of January. Eva Novotny, what are the main changes that you expect from this new administration, not only for Europe, but in general for the world?
Well, I think one of the main things that we can expect from this new administration is a return to a more multilateral view of diplomacy, of interaction with the outside world, a way back to support for international institutions, international organizations, and a more, balanced relationship, which has been missing in our view, in the European view, in dealings with the last administration. At the same time, when we are looking sort of at global affairs, we must not forget that President-elect Biden is going to have an enormous array of domestic problems to resolve. Not only the pandemic, and that has been sort of even in our conversation here, a dominant factor, but also the economic consequences, the social consequences, the increasing poverty, the increasing inequality, infrastructure problems, race problems. I mean, there is an array of problems that is enormous and that has to tackle. So I assume that while the president in the United States Constitution still has the primordial role in shaping foreign policy, a lot of the actual work in foreign policy will be the responsibility of Mr. Blinken as Foreign Secretary. And there we have somebody who is close to Europe, who is very well connected in Europe, who has lived in Europe, who has a basic understanding also of the workings, the complicated workings of the European Union. And I think for the transatlantic relationship, Europe-United States, we can really expect some progress here. The main problem that I see for the European Union, and we have touched upon, is the European Union will have not only to work out a new relationship to the US, but to reshape and reset its relationship to Russia, as well as to China. And here I agree with what Stephen has just said. To some extent, I think the problems that have derailed, in a way, the process that was going on was less, the derailment was less due to COVID, because everybody is fighting with the same problem or confronted with the same problems here. Yeah, and Europe was never among those who spoke about the China virus and so forth. We saw the dimension of the problems quite clearly. It was rather Hong Kong and the treatment of the protesters in Hong Kong, the very harsh treatment, and also the harsh treatment to some of the protesters and some of the dissidents in the aftermath of the Hong Kong demonstrations.
Let me ask Nina Khrushcheva. Putin had a special relationship with the person who is still president in the White House, and Putin's influence in American politics and was an issue in American politics. How is Putin, how is the Russian leadership looking to the new Joe Biden leadership and the fact that Donald Trump, they are sort of, who has been sort of their allies, leaving the White House?
Well, I mean, and I think I've spoken about it at Kreisky Forum probably more than once, that a lot being made about Putin's special relationship with Trump. I just would like to once again remind everybody that Putin doesn't have special relationship with Trump. Trump has special relationship with Putin, because he talks about Putin, my man, all the time. I mean, comparing to, say, Erdogan relationship with Putin, Turkey's Erdogan relationship with Trump. That is a special relationship. So it's more ideological than it is personal in any way, because the Democrats under Barack Obama were understandably and incredibly critical of Putin, including the Ukraine situation. And so, of course, when Trump came in and started saying that, we're going to be friends with Russia, we'll make it, and so on and so forth, of course, the Kremlin was very excited about it. Nothing really happened. In fact, there were more sanctions under the Trump administration than there were under Obama administration. But ideologically, of course, Trump needed Putin as a kind of a counterbalance to the Democrats. And of course, the Russians were technically supportive of Trump because it was kind of the enemy of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So if the Democrats are, if Trump is the enemy of the Democrats and Putin is the enemy of Democrats, so the Trump would be the friend of Putin. That's why I think they've been very careful and very silent about the president-elect Biden. And every time when Putin was asked about it twice, and his press secretary talked about it a few times, saying that we are going to wait until the official tally is out, which is supposedly today. And when Putin was asked, so you haven't congratulated President-elect Biden yet, and you seem to be the outlier in this, Putin's, wouldn't it make the relationship worse? Putin's response was sort of deadpan, saying, you can break something that is already completely broken. So that's how Russians enter this conversation. Certainly, and Eva mentioned Blinken, who understands Europe and likes Europe, and equally dislikes Russia. I think last year or 2 years ago, he wrote a piece in the New York Times, which was called behold Vladimir V. Potemkin and his whole argument that Russia is nothing more, Putin's Russia is nothing more than a Potemkin village. So it just doesn't seem like it's bode for kind of good the beginning of a good conversation. But what
Nina,
I
also... can I interrupt you for a moment? We'll just continue in a second, but this is the first part of our conversation. I have to say goodbye from the viewers and our friends at the TV station W24. Das heißt, ich muss mich jetzt verabschieden von den Zuseherinnen und Zusehern auf W24. Hier ist unsere Sendezeit zu Ende, aber die Diskussion geht weiter im YouTube-Kanal des Bruno-Kreisky-Forums, im YouTube-Kanal des Falter und im Falter-Podcast. Ich wünsche Ihnen alles Gute im neuen Jahr und bleiben Sie dran. Nina, let's continue this discussion. So Joe Biden is not an unknown in Russia, is
he? No, he's absolutely not an unknown. And when, in fact, the problem with Ukraine broke out in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine, Biden was Barack Obama's point man on dealing with Ukraine, having relationship with Ukraine versus having no relationship with Russia, and basically arguing against Putin. Also, as you, of course, remember when Navalny got poisoned and Trump was very slow in saying anything about it. I think he did ultimately said that we resent that it happens in Russia. Joe Biden was very quick to come out and say, I'm going to hold it against Putin. So just to conclude quickly, I think it's the relationship. Russians are not expecting much. They expect more sanctions. They also expect more lecturing because Trump was also not lecturing Russia on human rights and so on. So Biden administration would certainly be seizing up on this kind of issues. But something that Eva said, and it gives me a little bit of hope. I hope it is going to be professional administration. So the mid-level official, those who deal with foreign policy actually can get, regardless of the language, they can get some things done. The nuclear armament agreements, the climate agreements, the potentially some sort of resolution in Syria, some things that can be dealt with Taliban in Afghanistan, things that Russia has a foot in those places, and if played correctly or if handled correctly, actually they can be allies rather than enemies in those issues. So this is something that even Russian admit can be a positive resolution with this particular administration, which ultimately, which generally is not welcomed by the Kremlin.
Stephen, the Chinese President Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin are on the same line on many international questions. This is an alliance which is unusual and gives these two countries, huge countries, Russia with a huge potential of weapons, nuclear weapons, and foreign policy in the Middle East, China with its economy. Are these two giants in... each of them being a giant in its own way, are they going to stay a factor in world politics acting together? How do you see that?
I think it's fair to say that the relationship between the two countries is probably as strong as it's been in 50 years or more. And the reasons for that, I think, have a lot to do with both countries' interest in balancing the unipolar world led by the United States. That was a shared interest that leaders in both countries have pursued. And they see the advantage in working together on that front. And they both, I mean, they ideologically, they're quite different. They have historical differences. They have economic differences. There's a great deal of tension if you go to the border on either side, as I know Nina has done, and you know, talk to people, ordinary people. They really don't like each other. But I think that
anti-Russian racism in China and anti-Chinese racism in Russia, sort of.
Exactly, and you know, some of that is historical. Some of it's cultural. But I think that the governments see a lot of value in cooperating. Some people will say, and first of all, the Chinese will say they do not seek a military alliance with Russia, but they do look for ways that they can cooperate and partner. They're taking part in joint exercises and even joint patrols this year, which was really an interesting development over Japan. And so I think you'll see more and more of that kind of cooperation going on. But very rarely will you see them, I think, teaming up against somebody else. I just don't think it'll take that shape.
How does China see the new upcoming administration in the US? The relationship between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump was very, very contradictory on the personal level. The two leaders seemed to spare each other of attacks, but on the political level and an economic level, China and the U.S. Really are in a confrontation course. But if you watched the discussion in the U.S., it seemed the Republicans and Democrats didn't agree on anything except on being hard against China. So how does China see the Biden administration? Less instability, maybe more possibility to calculate, to know what this new administration is going to do? Or is it rather seen as a threat because of a new way to organize anti-Chinese alliances in the Far East?
Well, first, I would echo what Nina said about the Trump-Putin relationship. I think Trump saw and, in fact, referred to Xi Jinping as being a great friend and working well and doing a great job for his country. He said that as recently as March. And then, of course, as the campaign heated up, you saw a dramatic shift in the rhetoric that came both from Trump himself, but especially from the other members of the administration. I mean, Pompeo spoke of the rivalry between the United States and China as a generational fight against a I think he called it a bankrupt totalitarian regime. So I think a lot of people in China over the last couple of years, but especially in this last year, saw that kind of rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration and will be very happy to see that in the rearview mirror. I think they hope, as many do in Europe and elsewhere, that the Biden administration will come in with a more sensible or at least more familiar traditional form of diplomacy. And I think on that level, they think they will be able to find ways to cooperate. But as you rightly point out, the mood in the United States has shifted dramatically, and as it has in Europe. And there's a great deal of wariness now towards the kind of country that China is becoming. I mean, really, for decades, administrations of both parties saw an interest in engaging with China, especially on economic issues and trade, as a way to bring China into the global community and into the sort of world order that had emerged after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. And instead, what you've seen, especially under Xi Jinping, is a much more authoritarian China emerging, one that's more authoritarian at home and more aggressive outside of its borders in a way that it really hasn't been in many, many years as it focused on its reform and opening and its economic success. And I think that people are waking up to the nature of China under Xi Jinping, who by the way, eliminated term limits. So he's going to be around, I was thinking the other day, certainly past the Biden administration, barring some unforeseen event. He could quite possibly still be the Chinese leader, two elections from now. And so I think people are now trying to figure out what kind of relationship we can have. The international community can have with this newly powerful China, an economic power, a military power.
Ivan Novotny, where does that leave Europe? We have this perspective of growing confrontation between the United States and China, the established superpower and the new growing superpower. That's always a very dangerous situation in history. And do the Europeans think that they'll have to take sides, either be more pro-Chinese or be pro-American. And that if that would be the case, they would probably try to be pro on the side of the United States. Is that a good predisposition rather to side with the Americans against China?
Well, I think, first of all, the Europeans will try very hard to avoid being forced to take sides and do everything in their power to avoid such a situation. What we perhaps tend to ignore is that in the case of Europe, it's no longer a question of engaging with China because China is already a presence in Europe. Yeah. There has been a lot of Chinese financial direct investment. It goes beyond the mere trade and the mere deals that are brokered. So China is already here as a factor, and Europe has a vital interest in keeping this relationship on an even keel. The problem is that when it really comes to a confrontation between the US and China, which we all hope will sort of be a political confrontation and not in any other way, then I think your guess that Europe will side with the United States on the basis of common values, principles, and so forth is the most likely outcome. But as I said, Europe will do as much as they can to avoid such a confrontation and to avoid being pushed in a situation where they have to take sides.
Nina, you know, if I could just jump in there one second. One of the things that we've seen in the last few months in the case of Australia is that China is forcing countries to take aside. In other words, if you want to enjoy the investments from China, you know, the trade, the privileged status and what have you, you have to accept China's point of view on critical issues. In the case of Huawei, for example, and 5G, on Xinjiang, on Hong Kong, on any number of issues, Taiwan, certainly, even the South China Sea. And China has showed that it is willing to punish countries economically, and they're cutting off much of the trade they have with Australia to make a political point. And I think that you've seen that happening with Norway, you've seen it happening with Sweden and other countries in Europe face that crisis if for some reason they cross China on a certain policy issue. So I understand the instinct to avoid a confrontation. And I think that's been the policy of many countries in dealing with this giant economic giant that they have to deal with. But I think China is setting its terms much more stringently now than they have in the past. And I think that's part of what's driving this confrontation.
I'd like to move a little bit again to the question of the new Biden administrations and the expectations we have. Nina Khrushcheva, there have been arms control negotiations. They had been blocked by the Trump administration. There had been the question of how to deal with Iran that the Trump administration got out of that deal, and other areas too. From the Russian perspective, this idea that there is going to be a renewal of international cooperation linked to the Biden administration, is this something that the Kremlin might be interested in? Is that something the Kremlin might see an opening in? What do you think?
Well, they do, as I said, I think at the beginning, is that they always say that, you know, we're always open for to cooperation, but it's the other side that is just being very difficult about it. So I'm sure there are some people who think that it would be useful. And I go back to my point is that in the middle level, there are people who are ready to have some sort of cooperation on, you know, on Iran, maybe on Cuba, on other things that that Russia has connections maybe with China, because I think Stephen's point is very well taken, is that China is very now is getting strong arming those who are disagreeing. And that's where Russia becomes a very, very convenient player, because, of course, economically, Russia is far inferior. But Putin's Russia certainly has shown that it's very willing to take a political fight and sort of side with China against all others, because they do want to argue for a multipolar world. So that actually becomes an important play here. So yes, they are hopeful, I guess, but hopeful is not the right word. They're willing to work, but I don't think that the Russians, and certainly this Kremlin, doesn't think that it's going to result in anything tangible, at least certainly not for the Russia's benefit, precisely because, for example, when Trump came in and it was all this brouhaha and big conversation how we're going to be friends with Russia, and of course that didn't work out. I mean, it couldn't have worked out. In fact, it got worse rather than better. So I don't think there is much expectations. And that's why I think once again, as much as Putin is being upset with Germany or annoyed with Europe, they are probably having more interest at looking into how Europe deals with the Biden administration and see how they can play with it. I mean, how they can be part of that conversation rather than directly with America, because I don't think there is much expectation. There is much expectation there.
One point of contention that we didn't mention yet is Belarusia. Huge, since months, huge demonstrations, huge confrontations between demonstrators on the street, people on the street, and the Lukashenko government. Interestingly, Americans have been very quiet. A big difference with the situation in Ukraine a couple of years ago. The Europeans have been less quiet, but don't see any way to influence the situation. How is that seen in Russia? I mean, does the Russian public see the Belarusian situation somehow as as something that can happen different or does happen on different levels in Russia itself? Or is that something that's seen as a rearm of a completely different, in a different world? Because Belarusia is Russian culture and linked with many, many ties to Russian civilization.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think there is such a thing as a Russian civilization. I mean, Russians think that there is, but what is a Russian civilization? But it is certainly part of the Slavic world, although not always has been, but lately for sure. Well, I mean, Belarus is not Ukraine, and let's be very honest about this. Russia is, as Pompeo kept saying, and everybody else is saying, it's an existential enemy to the United States. I mean, the Cold War is over, but we're still fighting. I mean, America is still fighting that, sometimes fair, sometimes entirely ridiculously. But when Belarusian protests began, it wasn't Ukraine, because Ukraine was arguing for being part of the European civilization. The same thing with was Georgia, as you remember, in 2008. Belarus had no anti-Russian slogans for very, very long time. I think it still it still doesn't have it. And so in this sense, to America, it has no value, because if it's not anti-Russian, there's some speck on the map that we don't know, is some little piece of land between the Soviet Union and Europe somewhere, because Belarus is a very interesting, I mean, they still have Lukashenko, the president, the current president, who is holding on to power. As you may remember, he was the collective farm head at some time. So it's still a very Soviet environment in many ways. I think Putin actually played badly that hand. I don't know how sharp he is still as an operator, because in fact, supporting Lukashenko, and I understand why he did, sort of the dictators or whatever, the autocrats side up with other autocrats, he actually lost the Belarusian population, because the Belarusian people were looking at the Russians for help and were thinking that could be some assistance, because in fact one of the opposition figures of Lukashenko, Viktor Babariko, was Russia-related representative of the Gazprom Bank. So Putin failed the Belarusians, and I think they are now looking into Europe, which, by the way, is by Putin's doing. One of the things that, one of the reasons Putin may not have wanted to support the public versus Lukashenko is that exactly that. He was afraid that then if he goes to the will of the street, then Russian street would start interfering with his politics. So far they've been able to suppress this to some degree, but there is really no solution to this until Putin, and it sounds completely ridiculous, until Putin lets it go, it would be very difficult for Belarusians to create the independent free society. So it's something that we have to see from the Russians, from the Kremlin coming, that Lukashenko, as he promised, there would be another constitution, he would be then stripped of some of his powers and eventually resign. How long that will take, that is a question. And the more that continues, that kind of weird status quo that Lukashenko is a president-elect, but he's not really a legitimate president because we don't know how many people actually voted for him, the more Russia is losing Belarus as a country that is part of that kind of this Slavic space that it still keeps. And I think this is something that Putin needs to address, but so far he seems to be failing in that.
Ivan Novotny, since months now, these demonstrations in the streets of Minsk and other Belarusian cities, can the Europeans do more than declare their support for the demonstrators and there had been sanctions, but in a limited way, and they don't seem to have any effect. Could the Europe do more?
Well, first of all, they have not recognized the outcome of the election. So they have not recognized the re-election of President Lukashenko. They have established contacts with a number of dissidents who have been also invited to Brussels and have been in contact with all the other European leaders. And there have been sanctions, individual sanctions against a number of people, as well as sort of sanctions, economic sanctions in the relationship to Belarus. I don't see much more they can do at the moment. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those situations where you just have to hope that sooner or later the pressure is so big that it will have to that it will lead to an outcome, but. Other means, there is not much in the toolbox that the European Union could use.
Lukashenko seems to be convinced that repression will work at the end. And
I'm not so sure, because it has been very repressive, but the pressure from the street has not given up. Yeah, demonstrations have, in fact, gotten larger over the time and more determined. So we have seen in a number of other situations that finally the regime perhaps will have to give in because the pressure is too big to withstand it anymore.
And that would be one of the questions of 2021.
Yes.
Asia, Hong Kong, repression seems to work and seems to be able to silence the opposition. One of the main newspaper publishers has been arrested. Members of the local legislative council have been arrested. Stephen, does repression work in Hong Kong? Do we have to admit that that's the case, even if we hate it?
Well, I was just thinking of Tiananmen Square in 1989. And I think at a certain level, you know, it takes a lot of factors, I think, to for a government to collapse. You know, we saw it in 89 in Europe. We saw it in 91 in Russia. And, you know, in Hong Kong, I think there's a recognition that it's part of China, and China's not keeping its agreement, the commitments it made to respect the special status and culture of Hong Kong, as well as Macau, by the way. And, you know, they've, you know, pressed ahead. And I think partly because of the protests last year and the concern over that, they decided that now was the moment that they were simply not going to tolerate that. And, you know, you do not see protests, you know, gathering any momentum inside China either. And so Hong Kong's becoming much more like the mainland in that sense. And, you know, whenever there's a sign of dissent, it's put down very quickly. So it's not allowed to get to the level that it has in Belarus in recent months. And, you know, it's interesting that, like, diplomatically speaking, we talk about, like, where Russia and China agree. You know, China's first principle is non-interference in other countries' affairs. And while, of course, they interfere in other countries' affairs all the time, the principle is that they, you know, think countries should be left alone. And that's why they have a certain appeal to other autocratic nations. And, you know, I think they'll argue that their system works and therefore people have no reason to protest. But the vehemence of the crackdown suggests that they are a little bit worried about popular sentiment.
Nina Khrushcheva, China, the biggest, most populous country in the world, gets more authoritarian. How would you see Russia on this level? Is there have been protests in the Far East in Russia? There had been protests in other parts of Russia. Is the it's not clear if there is a clear direction. Is there a clear direction for the government, for the political system in Russia? Does it get more authoritarian, or is that not true?
No, it is getting more. I mean, I'm very hesitant to use all this kind of labels just because it's more complicated than that. But certainly it's in the in 2012 when Putin came back to his third term as president, it has turned more authoritarian, more autocratic. In 2018, when he once again became president, it was getting more autocratic. I mean, if you walk around Moscow, even without any protest, there is a lot of police. I mean, it is a police state, just in case something would happen, just in case something would break out. If there was a holiday, there would always be an incredible police presence, just in case somebody would go and protest. When Belarusian protests broke out, there were people arrested next to the Belarusian embassy. So it's not like the Chinese. I mean, we're not that organized. It's really not, I mean, I'm afraid even to use this word, but it's certainly not dictatorial. So it's not that sweeping, but there's certainly oppression has grown for sure. I mean, in 2015, I went to the Red Square and I put a sign on my chest saying Putin is a dick in Russian. So it makes no sense in Russian. And I wasn't arrested and I was expected to be arrested, but I wasn't. It was just kind of shooed away. I would never have done it today. I would have been very afraid to do it because God knows what the result would be. So it is, it's certainly getting tougher and tougher, but it's also, I mean, something that I mentioned at the beginning is that it's really unclear where this regime is going. You know, there's a constitutional amendments, which allows Putin now to delete all the previous 20 years that he had in the Kremlin. And now he's starting anew as if it's just, you know, he's fresh and young for another, how many, 12 years, right? So it'd be 12 years after 2024, with his this term expires, then it would be another 12 years. But then at the same time, there is a new law that the former president will become a senator for life and he will have complete political immunity. What does it mean? Does it mean that Putin is stepping down next year? Because that's another thing that we haven't discussed, and we should, because it is a possibility that he's going to stay on for some time. But it's also a possibility that by 2024, which is, as I said, an expiration of this term, he's looking for way out. And we still don't know who is going to come in. And that would be a very important question as to where Russia is going, how it's going, and what kind of relationship it will have with the world. In fact, I think that one of the reasons that Alexei Navalny, there was an attempt on Navalny's life, is exactly with Belarus being in protests, when COVID having people's discontent. So it is possible that they wanted to take a leader of the opposition out. So Russia, as stable as it may seem, it's actually on a very, very, very shaky ground. And this is probably something that one time the Kreisky Forum need to discuss sort of in the, say, next 6 months.
There had been observations since quite some time. There has been a rehabilitation even of Stalin in the political culture of Russia. I wonder if that is still the case. And I think many of our viewers will be interested to know if people realize you are the granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, the guy who started de-Stalinization in the Soviet Union. How do people react?
Well, I mean, the Stalin, the kind of rehabilitation of Stalin, so to speak, has happened. I think Stephen was still a Moscow bureau chief, or was a Moscow bureau chief when it was all happening, right, Stephen? Because it began in the early 2000s. I think in 2006, I believe, one of the Moscow subway stations suddenly got Stalin name, and, you know, is a quote from the Soviet anthem with a Stalin name on it. Well, people don't react to me because they don't really, I mean, they don't put two and two together, but there is a kind of funny thing that happened. I was looking for Khrushchev busts in gift shops, and there was everybody except for Khrushchev. And I said, so what happened? Why there is no Khrushchev? Nobody's interested. Nobody's asking for him. And why do you even need Khrushchev? You have Stalin and Putin right here, those busts. And then there was a play about Gorbachev, beautiful, very well done. And every single leader of the Soviet Union was mentioned in the play except for Khrushchev. And I said, so where is Khrushchev? Like, oh, no, it's not really that important because he has no influence on Gorbachev, which, of course, is not true. So in many ways, Khrushchev has fallen out of history.
Well, we are coming to the end of our discussion. I would like to have a perspective of all of you on what, generally speaking, we expect the pandemic to do to world politics in the next year. It will not be gone in a short time. It may be gone after the summer. It may be last longer, but it will be an issue for all our countries. Eva Novotny, how do you see, how will the pandemic in this year influence Europe and influence the world?
Well, I think for one thing, and this is something that we are going to see, is that there is going to be an increasing international competition for access to the vaccines that are now coming on the market. And that has already begun, and unfortunately with some very nasty nationalistic overtones, which if you think of that as a major health problem that confronts the whole world, is really deplorable. So access to vaccines, especially for the poorer countries, is going to be a very crucial problem for the next year. The other thing that I see in relationship to the pandemic is, and it's a question that we have to ask, what is it doing internally in the States? What are the political, social, economic results of the pandemic within the States? What are we going to do with that part of the population that has now succumbed to all sorts of conspirational theories and are getting more fantastic every day, thinking about sort of how this virus came about and so on? and what it is going to do, that there are sort of microchips being implanted in them and God knows what. I mean, this is going to be sort of a large segment of population in almost all our countries that has to be brought again on the basis of rational thinking and in a way on a democratic level. The second thing which I think is very important is, and this is something which in my opinion we have not really sufficiently touched upon, the Biden administration is going to bring in a number of very professional, experienced people who have been ousted in the Trump administration and are now in sort of work waiting patterns in different think tanks, and so they will all come back into government. And that, I think, is a big asset for international relations, that they will become more professional, calmer in the tone, and perhaps more, again, multilateral in thinking.
Stephen, the pandemic, meaning China gets stronger and stronger, or, I mean, that would also be an interesting question. The conspiracy theories that Eva mentioned in Europe and in the US, do we have them? I guess we have them in Asia too, because we have everything that exists in the world in Asia, don't we?
The big difference is that the if you hear them, at least in Chinese media, you know that they're being at least tacitly endorsed by the government. Conspiracy theories that are anti-government, of course, are quickly censored and disappeared. I think that the pandemic has been a huge shock for China, as it was for everybody. But I also feel, as I mentioned earlier, that China really feels like they've figured out how to handle it and how to bring it under control, how to make sure it doesn't flare up again. And now you're seeing the economic rebound beginning. China, I think, is going to have the world's largest economic growth this year when it seemed impossible only a few months ago. And I think that going into the new year is going to increase the confidence of Xi and his vision of China, despite the missteps in the beginning, despite the diplomatic fallout that they have experienced, despite the anger around the world over Hong Kong and other issues. I think you're going to see a much more aggressive China on a variety of fronts. We've seen this already with India, with Australia, with tiny Bhutan, and I would expect a lot more of that in the year ahead.
Nina, any elements of this Chinese optimism in the Russian approach towards the pandemic?
No, not at all. I mean, in the summer when the numbers were going down, there was a conversation about European countries that, you know, Russians have figured it out and Europe just really let it drop, but no more. I think the vaccine is a very important question because Russians, of course, already started testing. And the big argument is that their vaccine is much cheaper than any other vaccine. And Putin already offered it to the United Nations and to everybody else. And so it is a possibility. If it does work, Russians would be very willing to distribute it in poorer countries. And that's how kind of push forward its own potentially soft power. So we'll see how it plays out. I don't think they will be allowed that either for objective reasons or ideological reasons, but they surely, the Kremlin surely would try. And so while last thing I want to say about this, and I also think it seems to me that it's not only vaccine nationalism, but also because every country had to deal with coronavirus on its own and China is doing so well. My fear for the world is, though we are calling for unity, it's actually going to be more inward looking because they all be competing for economic markets, for economic development, for recovery and whatnot. So rather than more cooperation, I would see less cooperation, though more talk about the cooperation.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds like a year of challenges ahead of us, despite the vaccine. And there are some challenges there is no vaccine for. but the world will be confronted. Thank you very much with your insights from Seoul, from Moscow and from Vienna. Vielen Dank fürs Mitmachen. Vielen Dank an Sie zu Hause für Ihr Interesse. Der Falter Podcast, der YouTube-Kanal des Bruno Kreisky Forums und der YouTube-Kanal des Falter verabschieden sich von Ihnen. Ich verabschiede mich von Ihnen, wünsche Ihnen alles Gute im Jahr 2021 und bleiben Sie dran, bleiben Sie gesund und auf ein nächstes Mal.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.